This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to Extra with me, Geraldine Doog, where we strive to bring you the best of our international coverage from our regular Saturday program. Today, Venezuela. That country remains paralysed, with two men, Nicolas Maduro and Juan Guaido, each claiming they are the rightful president since January this year. 7 months down the track, US sanctions against Venezuela have been intensified, and reports have emerged of torture and the killing of at least one rebel member of the military by the Maduro regime. People were already starving and leaving the country in droves because of its economic breakdown, and that's, of course, what led to this political crisis. So how will the impasse ever be resolved? Raul Sanchez Uribarri hails from that troubled country. He's at Melbourne's La Trobe University, where he teaches law and politics, focusing on Latin America. Welcome, Raul.
Thank you very much.
Ambassador Carlos Vecchio, the latest setback is that President Maduro has walked away from negotiations with the opposition leader Juan Guaido, who of course is recognised by the US and many other countries as the rightful president. Now, Maduro walked in protest at new US sanctions. Do you know if those negotiations had been making progress to that point?
Look, it's a very important question, and we can only answer it partially, unfortunately. We know from an outsider, we can see that they've been progressing. We've seen that they have held different meetings in Barbados. This is sponsored by the Norwegian government. But unfortunately, there is very little we know about what's being actually spoken within the negotiations at the talks. However, when we see Maduro walking out and being able to sort of sit out of the negotiations at least for the time being, we can assume that, of course, part of the government, part of the ruling coalition on the Maduro side, doesn't support the talks, or it sees some gain by not participating fully.
Norway was brokering those talks, weren't they? They're facilitating.
Correct.
Yeah, right. Now, Ambassador Carlos Vecchio, who represents the opposition leader, Guaido, in Washington, he was upbeat about the sanctions that are being imposed in a PBS interview this week, and he suggested they would be effective because they targeted the upper echelons of Maduro's regime,
Correct.
His inner circle, but not ordinary Venezuelans. So what sort of sanctions do that, I wonder?
Well, we have to see it in the following way. From the Maduro regime's point of view, in fact, one of the main reasons for holding negotiations was precisely that without the sanctions, or with the sanctions in place, they are not able to secure external financing involving the United States in different shapes or forms, bonds and so forth. But also it makes it more difficult for entities and business that do business with the United States as well to do business with the Venezuelan government. And the key here is, of course, that these contracts and business opportunities and whatnot are tied to the ruling elite, are tied to those sectors within the military, within the civilian elite that support, that prop up support for the Maduro regime. So that's what Carlos Vecchio is talking about. Mm. Unfortunately, we also know that these sanctions also hit the Venezuelan people. So, of course, this is a catch-22. On one hand, the sanctions put pressure on the regime. On the other hand, they also affect, at least to some degree, the Venezuelan population.
Could you give us a brief snapshot, please, of how people in Venezuela are surviving? Do people still go to work? Where are they getting food?
This is the most important question. We need to keep the focus along the way on the Venezuelan people and their experience in this situation. It's, of course, really hard to live in Venezuela at the moment, to conduct your daily business, to be able to raise a family, do all the things that we want to do as human beings. Very difficult, for example, for a vast majority of the population to afford basic staples, even if they find it. A lot of staples have actually been effectively dollarized, and we're talking about a country where close to 80% of the population make less than $5 a month. I mean, that this is the scale of the collapse that's happening. So a lot of people, to answer your question directly, unfortunately, are not really surviving. And this is what explains the exile we've witnessed in the past couple of years particularly.
And so what about things like utilities, services, electricity, gas? I mean, are they still working, or have people gone back to a whole different age?
Well, the way we have to see it, I mean, the magnitude of the collapse, this is equivalent of a family that at some point was able to afford, a nice vehicle, and then years later can't really keep it up. So you have, for example, Venezuela has the electrical power grid, when it was designed and built back in the 70s and 80s, was actually top of the line in Latin America and probably in the global south. And nowadays, it's not really hard to keep it up, to run it, to maintain it properly. As a result, it collapsed in March, April. Vast swaths of the country are subject to regular blackouts. I can tell you, my hometown, for example, Maracaibo, second largest city in the country, has most of the city has power only every 6 hours.
So every 6 hours. So what do you do for the rest? What, candles? And
So imagine just trying to conduct your life, adjusting your life patterns to having power every 6 hours.
This would be a city the size of what?
Brisbane. With all the modern, you know, universities, hospitals, road network, all the things that you imagine in a modern city.
Well, what about people at the universities and schools? Are they still working?
Well, they work, and like everything else in Venezuela at the moment, they work out of, honestly, out of the goodwill of those who are waking up every day to try to do the right thing and try to fulfill their honor, their duties and obligations. The university system, for example, has effectively collapsed as well as a result of the low salaries. You know, many academics have left, and even students as well. But you still have universities with 60, 70,000 students. You know, some of the programs have to be suspended. For example, medical school postgraduate certificates that were the pride of the medical schools there until only a few years ago, nowadays have to close. So that gives you an idea. And of course, the schools, the beginning of the school year is bound to start in September, beginning of October, if I recall correctly. And I can tell you that at least 9 out of 10 families are not going to be able to afford the typical utensils that children use at school.
So, again, I mean, I feel like we've been hearing about this for months and months. We've been reporting on it, you know, way back, and it just still keeps rolling on.
Now that you're talking about time, that's particularly the harshest part of the whole process. On one hand, the uncertainty. You don't really know what's going to happen. You don't really know how long it's going to take before a sense of normalcy is recovered. And I think that from an external perspective, we can afford to think of time in a linear way. Tomorrow is tomorrow. Next week is next week. You can't really live like that in Venezuela anymore. That's the worst part. How can you know if in a month the country or wherever you're living is going to be having the same life experience? You know, it's really hard to say, right? So it goes down to that very sense of safety that we all need to live our lives. And it's really hard to describe.
Yes, it obviously is. And your own situation, going back to the way academics are behaving, those who are still there, are you yourself doing pro bono work, aren't you? You're just turning up in one particular class.
Yes, indeed. I mean, one of the angles of this story, of course, has been the flood of help, of engagement between the Venezuelan diaspora and the people there. And there are different ways in which you can help, of course, in addition to sending money if you can, resources, supporting Venezuela, Venezuelans outside. You can also engage with people who are there. And one way is, for example, in this case, we have a research unit that we were able to open as a block mode subject. I do it pro bono on the side. And this has 10 students who are doing their master's degree, top students, you know, very, very keen. And they are sorting out.
This is in comparative law.
In comparative law. So imagine this. They are sorting out all these difficulties to be able to read the materials daily, to get about, you know, studying and moving forward. And I can tell you those discussions about rule of law and democracy and what happens when they collapse are amongst the most interesting and engaging I've had in a while, and I can only say that I'm humbled to have that experience with them. It's actually admirable.
Look, the Maduro regime has just signed this Russian military deal too, which would allow Russia to send military ships to Venezuela. Is that significant?
Well, it's significant to some degree. I mean, on one hand, there's the signal, right, of Russia that continues to support its ally in Latin America and actually sending out a very powerful message as well that no matter what, they're willing to keep being a thorn on the side of the U.S. and the West on that part of the world. On the other hand, I wouldn't read too much into it. Unless we see new developments that we haven't seen before. Why? Because on one hand, there's been collaboration between the Venezuelan military and Russia and the Russian military for a long while. So many of these agreements are just keeping alive those agreements from the past. And others because we live at a time that precisely things are so shaky and they can change and they're so unstable that anything, any small event can actually be blown out of proportion. So if we see, for example, a Russian Navy ship visiting Venezuela, then there could always be the headline, the spin, the tweet, retweet, blah, blah, saying, hey, you know, no, here is Russia and he's ready to go to war. Not really. We have to try to be as sober as possible in these circumstances and see things in perspective.
Thank you very much indeed for that overview.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Raul Sanchez Uribarri from Melbourne's La Trobe University. On RN, you're listening to Extra, the best of Saturday's show with me, Geraldine Duke. When Frank Langfitt took an assignment as the US National Public Radio, NPR's Shanghai correspondent in 2011, he was struck by how much it had changed since his time there as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun in the late 90s and early 2000s, by how hard it had become to talk to ordinary people over how they were faring in the new China. So he came up with a novel idea. He offered free taxi rides in exchange for conversation. And much to his surprise, it worked. Frank spent the better part of the next 5 years getting to know China through his passengers. And his recorded experiences are now assembled in The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Stories, really, from an uncertain and pivotal moment in China's history, told by the people living through it. Frank is now NPR's London correspondent, and he joined us earlier for more on the adventures captured in this new book.
Hi, Geraldine. Thanks for having me.
Could you set the scene for us, Frank? What was happening in Shanghai when you arrived as the NPR's new Shanghai correspondent in 2011?
Well, Shanghai had changed dramatically. I'd actually been there in the 1990s. I had worked in China in the 90s as a journalist, and I'd been away for about 10 years. And when I returned to Shanghai, of course, it was just stunning, this incredibly vertical city, huge skyscrapers where I lived, tons of wealth. At the same time, there was incredible corruption, and basically the Communist Party was losing the faith of the people. So the country was at some kind of a turning point, but I wasn't clear in what direction it was going to head.
Right. So this very interesting idea of driving a cab, where did it come from?
I had done it back in Philadelphia when I was in high school and actually summers after college. Mm. And I found it was a great way to get to know the city I'd grown up in. And, you know, there's a certain intimacy in a taxi cab that people maybe think, well, I'm not going to see this person again. I might tell them what's going on in my life. So I found it was just a great way to get to know a wide variety of people quickly and hear really kind of what they were most interested in.
You even went to local companies, didn't you, asking for a job?
I did. So I didn't know. The question was, how would you do this, right? So I went to companies. I went to one company, I remember, and they just laughed out loud. And they said, this is not like New York. Foreigners don't drive cabs here. They're not allowed to. And so then we came up with an idea. I was working with my assistant, Yang Zhuo, and we came up with the idea to put magnetic signs on the side of a rented car. And they would say, this is a free loving heart taxi in Mandarin. It sounds better in Mandarin than it does in English. I'm translating it loosely. And then basically just said on the side of the car, also in Mandarin, free rides for free conversation, basically. And so I drove around the city and people started getting in.
Did you find people were skeptical or wary of getting
some were, and I got to say, I mean, part of the, you know, you're a journalist. Part of our lives are just being rejected for interviews, right? I mean,
certainly.
That's what we're used to. But what was really interesting is a lot of people saw the cab and they were like, oh, this is a pretty interesting idea. And I even remember taxi cab drivers reading the signs on the cab and giving me a thumbs up. Like, they like this idea.
Now, in fact, what your book does do is contain a number of really quite intriguing insights about the repercussions of China's rapid economic rise and how this was playing out on the ground in China at the time. For instance, you write about a road trip you took in 2015, driving two migrant workers from Shanghai back to Hubei province in central China. And you say that this experience, I'm quoting to you now, spoke to the chasm between much of China's countryside and its increasingly cosmopolitan cities such as Shanghai. So just give us a bit more about that, please.
Well, it's almost like different planets. And the countryside, it's now much more isolated than it was. And so many people have left these farming communities for the big cities so that the villages have been hollowing out. And so when we went back, when I drove these two men back to the countryside, you know, you would go back and it was just small farming communities, mostly older people and just little, you know, small children, and most of the working age people had long gone. And what was also amazing to me, it's not just the chasm, but also kind of a sense of the incredible progress from going from a rural to an urban country. You know, the people that I met who I drove back, the migrants, they had started off as farmers' kids, basically. And now two of them that I got to know were working as lawyers in Shanghai. And so you had this incredible transformation economically, where in one generation, something that might take two or three in Australia or the United States or here in the UK, people were living through this. And in many ways, I got to say, it's one of the most positive aspects of China in the last 20 or 30 years is that a rising tide really did lift most boats and people live much better. Generally, almost all my characters have much better lives materially than their parents did.
Quite. And in fact, what I found interesting, you said that these villages, and they're only, say, about 800 Ks from Shanghai, they were a decade or more behind the urbanites. So, you know, we worry about this in Australia, but I mean, this is a sort of, you know, at a much more stark level, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, it's great that you point that out about Australia, because this is also, this rural-urban gap is happening everywhere in the world, at varying degrees and paces. You see it in the United States, you see it here in England, where I am, and the Brexit vote and also what happened with Donald Trump. There's this tension between a rural area that really feels almost like it's falling further behind, and then these urban areas like a Shanghai or a London or Sydney that are incredibly wealthy and vibrant.
I mean, that's the point, isn't it?
Gosh. I mean, you've been to Shanghai. You know what it's like. It's arguably the most dynamic city you're likely to find
in
most of the world. And it's dazzling. And to just emphasize this point, when I went to this little village where I was a chauffeur in a local wedding for one of the people I drove back, what was amazing there is, this was 2015, and I was the first foreigner to ever set foot in the village. A lot of the villager people had never met a foreigner, which I found stunning.
Look, you write of Shanghai that, you know, there we are, a city of 24 million, there isn't enough to go around, and that some people see life as a Darwinian contest for space and spoils, favouring the most cunning, the best connected, and the least morally encumbered. But at the same time, you say that as people no longer needed to worry to the same extent about the basics, you saw a society emerging in which people considered the welfare of others and the greater good. And one character you met that personified this trend was Max, a barber from Yunnan province in China's southwest who provided free haircuts to elderly people. So tell us more about Max, please.
So Max had come out of the countryside, as you were saying, and he had worked his way up and built a big salon business, and he was doing quite well. But he felt really guilty for leaving his folks behind. He felt he wasn't a good filial son. And in order to do penance for this, frankly, he began to give haircuts for free to these elderly shut-ins. And I drove him one day to a local apartment building where he knew people, and we just went basically room to room, cutting hair for folks. And it was, what was so nice was to see that even amidst this incredible materialism in China and the fact that it can be very Darwinian, with wealth, people now, I just see a lot more kindness on the streets at the same time. And so it's a very mixed picture. And what I wanted to do with the book was give people a sense of how complex it is and how you can meet such different people that it's not remotely monolithic. I mean, the Chinese people now are much more heterogeneous than they were 20, 25 years ago. Many different points of view, you know, up and down the socioeconomic ladder. It's just a much more diverse country in terms of experiences and points of view.
Which do you think is making it, I don't want to get too political because I think all these marvellous characterisations are so helpful, but is it making it harder then for the Communist Party to hold the reins of such a diverse group of people?
Absolutely. That's what's going on. I think one of the reasons that Xi Jinping has cracked down is he realizes he has a totally different kind of society that he's trying to manage now. It's much more sophisticated. People have traveled overseas. They've had all kinds of experiences. Their expectations are pretty high because the people in my book who are maybe 30 or 33 years old, they've never known less than 6% annual GDP growth, which means there's no generation like them in human history. So they have great expectations. Well, how do you manage this? The Communist Party every day is all about survival. They know that they're an anachronism. And so the president feels that he has to be very heavy-handed because it's going to be an increasingly tough place to manage.
Yes, we talk quite a lot about this, actually, on this program.
I bet you do.
I'd like to go, as we sort of head towards the end, into some of those differences then between, say, America and China, which is such a live issue at the moment with the so-called trade war. Now, for example, you write, in terms of the cultural differences, in China you should try to take more time, be patient, be oblique, keep your feelings hidden. In conversations you touch on the main point, chat about other things, then circle back. Many Americans are more direct and less concerned with concealing anger. Now, in this much more heterogeneous group you've described, how are you seeing these differences play out?
Well, it's interesting because what I just described in the book is sort of a very traditional kind of Chinese approach that I encountered back in the 1990s. I would now say it is much more diverse, and lots of Chinese will be more direct and more blunt. Chinese that have worked for Western companies, particularly American companies, will actually like that Americans are more direct, even if it, by traditional Chinese standards, it's impolite, because it's more efficient. So while I stand by that statement generally that you just read, it is much more diverse now. And your experiences with Chinese people, especially generationally, in China, generations now 5 years. You can talk. I have one character in the book who at one point she's 27 and she says, I can't relate to these 22-year-olds. And that sounds funny to us, but in China,
no, I've heard that myself. I've exactly heard that from Chinese who are about 40.
Oh, and I mean, it is they are really different generations because everything happens so quickly.
Yes, I mean, I'm particularly interested in what Ashley, a young Chinese woman you met who went on to study and then worked in America, what she had to say about the changes in both countries and their relationship to each other.
I found her a fascinating figure because she is the daughter of Communist Party officials. She was very disillusioned with China, had moved to America in 2016 to get her MBA, as you're saying. And she was looking for freedom and openness and a better system. And 5 months later, Donald Trump was elected president, and she was really shocked by this. And she saw his illiberal tendencies. She saw some of his affection for authoritarian leaders. She found that very unsettling. And in the end, she actually goes back to China. So it's, you know, these are difficult times to find, if you're a young Chinese person, finding, you know, what is the right place to be.
Oh, look, final question, really. It's an impressionistic thing. What do you see coming for China? I mean, this is just, you know, you're just describing this, frankly, a cauldron of change.
I think we are in for a very tough time. I think Xi Jinping is not leaving office anytime soon. And it's very clear that his vision for his country is very authoritarian at home, very aggressive and assertive overseas. And you're seeing this conflict playing out over Huawei and 5G. So I think we're in for a number of very fraught years, no matter who's necessarily in the White House or necessarily here in number 10 Downing Street, for that matter. These are pretty chilly times in terms of relations between China and the West.
Look, thank you very much indeed. It's been terrific to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Geraldine.
Frank Langfitt and his Langfitt, and his book is The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. And I hope that you can check it out. It's a Weidenfeld and Nicholson publication. been listening to Extra. Join me, please, at the same time next week as we bring you more of our international coverage or online via the ABC website or the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.